Normally, when a major crisis is looming, say like a Category 5 hurricane, there's this built-in expectation of time.
Right,
You have a warning.
Exactly. You have meteorologists tracking the storm models, you see the path on the radar. And so you have days to, I don't know, board up your windows, evacuate if you need to, and just physically brace for the impact. There's this comforting, tangible buffer between the threat being identified and the storm actually making landfall.
And historically, the world of cybersecurity operated on a very similar timeline, right? Like a major software vulnerability gets discovered, a security bulletin goes out, and IT teams generally have a runway.
Yeah, a bit of breathing room.
Right. They have weeks, sometimes even months, to test a security patch in a safe environment, approve it, and then finally roll it out before malicious actors figure out how to, reverse engineer the flaw and weaponize it.
But the stack of cybersecurity incident reports and threat intelligence we are deep diving into today shows us a reality where that radar is, it's completely useless.
It really is.
The storm doesn't just form on the horizon anymore. It materializes inside your house before the warning sirens even have a chance to go off.
That's a great way to put it, honestly.
So our mission in today's deep dive is to look at the exact timeline of this CVE 2026-2020-30 crisis. We're going to unpack how a theoretical software vulnerability became a global automated crisis in less than a single day.
Which is just staggering speed.
It is. And we'll get into why the fundamental rules of cyber defense have changed permanently and how organizations can actually survive when attackers are moving faster than humanly possible.
To really understand the scale of what happened here, we have to look at the precise timestamps in the incident reports we've gathered. The inciting incident begins on Friday, June 23, 2026.
Friday night, always a Friday.
Always, specifically 6:03 Dairy PM Eastern Time. And this is a critical time block because most security managers and IT teams in the Western Hemisphere are, well, they're literally logging off.
Right, they're driving home, heading out for the weekend.
Exactly. And right at that moment, a security research firm called SSD Secure Disclosure publishes a highly detailed technical analysis. And alongside their white paper, they release proof of concept code, or a PACE, for a severe flaw in Cisco's communications systems.
And if this were, say, 2016 instead of 2026, defenders would read that report on Monday morning, right? They'd assess the risk on Tuesday and maybe deploy a patch by Thursday.
That would be the standard playbook, yeah.
But look at the timeline in our sources. At 04:06 AM UTC, the very next day, so we are talking less than 24 hours after the research was published, active real-world attacks are detected on the internet.
Just incredible.
These automated attacks were hitting the honeypots of a security firm called Diffuse Cyber, and the incoming traffic was being routed entirely through the anonymizing Tor network to hide the attackers' locations.
Less than 24 hours. From a published academic white paper to a fully weaponized automated global attack campaign.
So if you're listening to this and you manage a network right now, I really want you to imagine your company's entire communication infrastructure, like every single desk phone, every secure conference line being completely hijacked over a weekend.
Total loss of control.
Right. And the most chilling part, not a single password was compromised, stolen, or guessed to make it happen. But before we can really dissect how the attackers move so incredibly fast, I think we have to look at the vault they were actually breaking into.
Yeah, the target itself. So the primary target in this incident is the Cisco Unified Communications Manager, commonly referred to as CUCM.
Right.
And for anyone who might not interact with back-end telecommunications daily, you can basically think of CUCM as the central nervous system, like the beating heart of IP telephony for thousands of global organizations.
And the stakes here are vastly different than, a standard web server getting defaced with a funny image. We are talking about hospitals that rely entirely on CUCM for patient emergency systems and paging doctors.
Yeah.
We're talking about massive financial institutions processing billions of dollars in transactions over what they believe to be secure internal phone lines, government agencies, military logistics networks, emergency dispatch centers. It's massive.
Precisely. The fallout of a compromised CUCM server is catastrophic because of what that server controls. If an attacker gains administrative access, they can silently eavesdrop on any phone conversation happening within the organization.
Wow.
They can redirect calls, modify billing records, or just wipe the system entirely and shut down the internal communications network. Furthermore, because CUCM sits so deep inside the trusted internal network, attackers use it as a highly privileged beachhead.
Oh, to launch secondary attacks.
Exactly, deeper into the corporate infrastructure.
Which brings us to the vulnerability itself. The reports classify this as a server-side request forgery, or SSRF flaw. And according to the documentation, this flaw was embedded in a seemingly innocuous kind of lazy convenience feature in CUCM called WebDialer.
Right, WebDialer.
So from an end-user perspective, WebDialer just lets an employee click a phone number on a company directory web page to automatically make their physical desk phone dial that number.
Saves you maybe 3 seconds of typing.
Right, exactly. But the catastrophic flaw is that the WebDialer service doesn't aggressively validate if the destination it's being handed is actually a phone number.
And that lack of input validation is the open window. In a secure architecture, the system should say, I am only accepting 10 digits, nothing else.
But it doesn't.
It doesn't. So an attacker can send URLs with entirely different schemes. Instead of telling the server to dial a phone, they can command the server to look at its own highly sensitive internal files or force it to reach out to other hidden servers on the local network.
Okay, let's unpack this with an analogy, because I know the mechanics of SSRF can sound a bit abstract if you aren't, like, writing code every day.
Please do.
So imagine you have a fiercely loyal, incredibly efficient personal assistant who sits in a highly secure private office.
Okay, I'm with you.
Normally, I hand my assistant a sticky note that says, please dial this client's phone number. They dial it, no questions asked, because they completely trust me.
Right.
But an attacker secretly slips a forged note into my stack that says, go into the filing cabinet and read the company's confidential password file out loud. In the digital world, that looks like sending a command such as file colon slash 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 etc. slash password.
Yeah, the classic Linux password file.
Exactly. And because the assistant completely trusts any note coming from inside that office, they execute the command. The server itself becomes the attacker's unwitting tool, and it bypasses all the external firewalls because the malicious request is coming from inside the house, so to speak.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it, yeah.
Right.
Because the perimeter firewall just sees the CUCM server acting normally, reaching out to resources it usually talks to. The server believes it's just doing its job. It has no idea it's been manipulated into executing hostile commands against its own operating system.
So you trick the server into reading an internal file. But how do you bridge the gap between, you know, reading a text file and owning the entire network architecture?
It's a big leap.
It feels massive.
Yeah.
The jump from, I can see your configuration file, to I have total system domination.
Mm.
But the sources detail this incredibly sophisticated four-stage exploitation chain to make that jump.
Yeah.
And the really scary part, the entire process takes less than 10 minutes.
Yeah, 10 minutes is all it takes. So stage one is identification, and it is entirely automated. The attacker's script sends that malicious SSRF request you just described.
And what is it looking for?
A specific reaction. If the CUCM server returns an HTTP 200 status code, which basically just means, okay, request fulfilled, or if it returns a specific error message indicating it attempted to parse the file, the attacker instantly confirms the system is vulnerable.
So it's basically just jiggling the digital door handle to see if it's unlocked.
Exactly. And this initial reconnaissance stage takes less than 5 seconds.
Wow. Okay, so 5 seconds in, the server confirms it's vulnerable. Then we hit stage two, which the sources say takes roughly 30 to 60 seconds. And this is where the attackers deploy what the report calls a rogue service.
Right.
The attacker uses that exact same SSRF flaw, but instead of asking to read a file, they send a SOAP request containing a malicious Base64 encoded JRR file. And for context for everyone listening, a SOAP request is essentially just a standardized digital envelope used for exchanging structured information.
And Base64.
Right. Base64 is basically a way of translating binary code into plain text so that security filters don't instantly flag it as a dangerous program.
Exactly. They take this disguised digital envelope and bounce it through the server using the SSRF vulnerability. Because the internal architecture completely trusts the CUCM server, it accepts the envelope, unpacks the hidden Java file, and installs a rogue, unauthorized web service directly onto CUCM's internal Apache Access 2 framework.
So they've basically snuck a new service onto the server. And the moment that rogue service is active, the attacker moves to stage three, which is the web shell.
The web shell, yeah.
In about 10 to 20 seconds, they use their newly installed rogue service to write a JSP file, a Java server page, directly into a public-facing web directory on the server. And if you have ever worked in incident response, you know the word web shell is just the ultimate nightmare scenario.
It's a game over, usually.
It's a persistent backdoor. Now, the attacker doesn't need to use complex SSRF exploits anymore. They can literally just open a standard web browser, navigate to that hidden JSP file, and type arbitrary operating system commands directly into a text box.
Which leads directly to the final and really the most devastating step. Stage 4, root privilege escalation.
Right.
See, CUCM is a complex appliance, and by default, it runs several of its background services with root privileges.
And root is like the absolute highest level of administrative control in the Linux operating system, right?
Absolute highest, yes. So using the web shell they just installed, the attacker can execute local Linux exploits. For example, they might use the infamous pleakit vulnerability, which tricks the operating system into granting ultimate admin rights to a low-level user.
Or they could exploit something simpler.
Yeah, simple misconfigurations like cron jobs, which are just automated schedule tasks that are improperly running as root.
And just like that, the attack chain is complete. They escalate from a basic web user to the absolute super user of the machine. It is total, unmitigated control.
Total control.
They can monitor all network traffic, they can create hidden administrative accounts, and they can install deep persistence mechanisms embedded in the system startup files. So even if the IT team reboots the server, the hackers still have access.
And the total time from the very first probe to root access, under 10 minutes.
Under 10 minutes. That's terrifying.
The overarching takeaway from this four-stage chain is the modular, almost surgical precision of it. It beautifully and terrifyingly illustrates how a single, seemingly minor entry point, a web dialer feature meant to save an employee 3 seconds of typing cascades into total system failure.
10 minutes to execute the attack is alarming. But honestly, here is the most concerning piece of this entire deep dive for me. How on earth did the attackers engineer this highly sophisticated four-stage weapon overnight?
It's a great question.
Usually, translating a theoretical academic paper into a robust global attack tool takes a team of highly skilled exploit developers weeks to accomplish. They have to understand the academic code, customize it for specific corporate environments, write error handling routines, set up attack infrastructure. How did this happen in hours?
Well, the sources point to two massive colliding factors here. The first was the unusually high quality of the initial proof of concept itself.
Okay.
SSD Secure Disclosure didn't just publish an abstract academic theory. They published a fully operational modular exploit. It had built-in debugging. It was validated across multiple different versions of CECM, and it was immaculately documented.
So they made it really easy.
Very easy. They even included a Docker file, which is a virtualized container so people could easily spin it up and test it in isolated environments. The researchers effectively did 90% of the attacker's engineering work for them.
They didn't just provide the blueprints for a weapon. They basically handed over a loaded gun.
They did.
But even with a great PC, scaling it into a global automated campaign takes serious coding. And that brings us to the second factor, which honestly is the most unsettling part of this entire report. The introduction of artificial intelligence as an exploitation force multiplier.
Yes. The incident report highlights a fascinating experiment conducted by the Tekken Game Analysis team. They wanted to understand the mechanics of this rapid weaponization. So they took the academic PC code, fed it directly into the GPT-4 large language model, and engineered a specific prompt.
And what did they ask it to do?
They asked the AI to create an optimized version of the exploit. They instructed it to add multi-threading, which allows a script to scan thousands of targets simultaneously rather than one by one. And they asked it to apply obfuscation techniques.
To hide the code.
Exactly, to change the digital signature of the code so it could evade standard intrusion detection systems.
Okay, wait, let me push back a bit here because I feel like it's very easy to get swept up in AI hyperbole right now.
Sure, yeah.
Did the AI actually invent a new hacking technique?
Yeah.
Like, did it discover the zero-day flaw in Cisco's code? Or are we just looking at a really fast, highly efficient, copy-paste tool formatting existing code?
That is a crucial distinction, and your skepticism is entirely warranted. No, the AI did not discover the vulnerability, it didn't invent the SSRF technique, and it didn't conceptualize the four-stage chain.
Right.
It didn't hack anything in the creative sense. However, what the AI did was completely commoditize the exploitation process. It acted as an unparalleled force multiplier.
Right, it took away the heavy lifting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Before AI, taking an academic proof of concept and building a multi-threaded, robust, evasive scanning engine around it required a senior exploit developer. It required deep knowledge of network protocols and error handling. Now, A complete novice can paste code into an LLM, ask it to handle the complex engineering, and the barrier to entry drops from weeks of specialized labor to maybe 5 minutes of prompt engineering.
Wow.
The AI handles all the messy syntax, it randomizes the user agents to avoid fingerprinting, and it handles SSL connection errors perfectly. It takes human discovery and weaponizes it at machine speed.
And because that AI force multiplier made this weapon essentially free and instantaneous to produce, the attackers didn't need to be picky. They didn't meticulously target one or two specific companies.
No, they didn't have to.
They just cast a massive net over the entire internet to see who they could catch. And the global fallout was staggering.
The scope of the exposure detailed in the threat intelligence is massive. Scans conducted on June 25th via platforms like Shodan and Sensis, which act essentially as search engines for internet-connected devices and open ports, identified approximately 430,000 vulnerable internet-accessible CUCM servers globally.
430,000. And the geographic distribution of those targets is eye-opening. Looking at the data, the United States had the highest concentration by a massive margin, housing 42.8% of those vulnerable servers.
Nearly half.
Yeah. China was next at 11.3%, followed by India, the UK, and Germany. We are talking about hundreds of thousands of critical targets, hospitals, banks, infrastructure, just sitting there, completely exposed to a 10-minute automated takeover.
And this feeds directly into the modern criminal supply chain on the dark web. The ecosystem is incredibly specialized now. The individuals running these AI-generated scanners to find open servers are rarely the same people who actually deploy the final damaging payloads.
So the people scanning the internet aren't the ones actually locking up the hospital records?
No, usually not.
They're basically just digital lockpicks, popping the doors open and auctioning off the keys to the actual robbers.
That's exactly how the business model operates. These actors are known as initial access brokers, or IABs. Their sole job is to mass compromise networks using these fast exploits. And within 72 hours of the original PPOC being released, researchers observed root access to corporate CUCM servers being sold on Russian language dark web forums for roughly $35,000 per server.
$35,000 just for the access.
Just for the access.
And the buyers are the major ransomware syndicates groups like Lockbit or Black Hat.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
They purchase that root access, use the compromised CUCM server to pivot deeper into the corporate network, deploy their ransomware across thousands of internal workstations, and then they demand a $5 million ransom from the victim.
It's a vicious cycle.
And as the report points out, even if only 30% of those victims end up paying the ransom, every single entity in that criminal supply chain makes a massive industrialized profit.
It really is an economy of scale. And when you combine an AI-accelerated weaponization cycle with a highly organized, heavily funded criminal marketplace, the statistical chances of an organization surviving an unpatched vulnerability using traditional methods drop to near zero.
Yeah. With AI accelerating the weapons and dark web markets organizing the profits, it really feels like defenders have no chance here. It sounds incredibly bleak.
It does.
But one organization in our sources proved that survival is actually possible. They proved you can beat the 24-hour window, provided you don't just rely on the outdated patch and pray methodology.
Yes, this is the case study of Bank Mellet Iran, and it is a fascinating look at forced innovation.
Tell me about it.
So Bank Mellet is a medium-sized financial institution with about 180 branches nationwide, managing roughly 2,500 IT phones. And on June 24th, right as the global scanning began, they were running a highly vulnerable version of CUCM.
Okay, let's look at the timeline of their rapid response, because the stress of this IT team must have been off the charts. Day one, at 10:30 a.m., their security engineers see the threat intelligence about the active honeypot attacks.
Right.
By 11:15 a.m., just 45 minutes after reading the alert, they make the aggressive decision to completely cut direct internet access to their CUCM servers via their perimeter firewall.
And that rapid isolation was the critical first step. But the real aha moment in this case study isn't about patching. It's about the fact that they couldn't patch.
Oh, because of the sanctions.
Exactly. Because of international geopolitical sanctions, Bank Mellet was blocked from downloading the official Cisco remediation. They were entirely cut off from the standard vendor-supplied cure.
Which means they were forced to treat their network architecture itself as the immune system.
Yes.
So by day two, they had to build an interim solution to get their services back online safely. They deployed a reverse proxy using HProxy to sit in front of their vulnerable servers.
And a reverse proxy basically acts as a rigorous bouncer at the door.
Right. And they configured this bouncer specifically to inspect all incoming web traffic and drop any requests containing those SSRF indicators, effectively shielding the vulnerable web dialer service without taking the physical phones offline.
This is the absolute definition of defense in depth. They neutralize the attack vector at the architectural level rather than just waiting for a software update. Eventually, on day 5, they managed to acquire the official patch through a third-party partner.
And their runbook for executing that Friday night maintenance is exactly how enterprise incident management should be handled.
It's textbook.
The precision is incredible. At 10.0 p.m., they run full configuration and database backups. At 10.20 p.m., they send automated SMS notifications to all employees warning them about the maintenance window, because transparent communication stops panic.
Absolutely.
Then they systematically patch the secondary subscriber nodes, verify the logs, and finally patch the main publisher node. By 1:30 a.m., they're executing system-wide verification, manually testing 50 internal calls, checking external SIP trunks, verifying voicemail.
And the ultimate result of Bank Mellet's architectural approach: zero downtime incidents during business hours.
Wow.
Zero user complaints. And most importantly, zero security breaches. They successfully navigated a 24-hour weaponization window because they didn't just wait for the vendor.
So if you are managing a network today, or if you are responsible for organizational risk, this incident fundamentally shifts your reality. You can no longer measure your patch response time in weeks. The CVE 2026-2230 crisis proves the old window is gone. You have to assume the attacks are coming the very same day the vulnerability is announced.
And unfortunately, that timeline is only going to compress further. Industry experts predict that by 2027, the vulnerability weaponization window will drop below 12 hours.
That's less than a single workday.
Right. The new paradigm requires proactive security. Organizations must adopt a zero-trust architecture. That means you never implicitly trust traffic just because it originates from inside the internal network. Every request, even from a trusted server like CUCM, must be continuously validated.
Furthermore, defenders have to fight fire with fire. You must use AI-powered defenses to combat AI-powered attacks.
It's the only way to keep up.
Right, because modern SIEM platforms use machine learning to detect behavioral anomalies, like a phone server suddenly trying to execute a system command that human analysts simply cannot spot in real time.
Exactly.
And even if you don't use Cisco systems at your organization, the next 24-hour exploit is coming for the infrastructure you do use. You need to be actively hunting for indicators of compromise. Don't wait for a vendor alert. Look for suspicious JSP files appearing in web directories. Monitor your network logs for unexpected outbound connections to Tor exit nodes.
Do not just wait for the fire alarm to ring. Actively go look for the smoke.
Yes.
Because in an era of hyperspeed exploitation, complacency is simply no longer a viable security strategy.
So true. In this deep dive, we saw what happens when artificial intelligence takes a human discovered vulnerability and weaponizes it in 5 minutes, turning an academic white paper into a global crisis overnight.
It's sobering.
But as AI models become exponentially more capable with every iteration, it leaves us with a final chilling question for you to mull over. What happens to our global digital infrastructure the day an AI model decides to skip the human entirely?
Yeah.
What happens when it starts independently discovering these zero-day vulnerabilities in critical systems on its own? Will we even get a 24-hour warning?
Yeah.
Or will the storm just suddenly be upon us?